Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, what's up, New York City, this is Amy Wilson. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI. We are a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States with 56,000 members nationwide. NYCDSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Is the United States in a strike wave? Some sources say that over 150 strikes have occurred since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States in March, with once overlooked workers in grocery stores, restaurants, and warehouses now deemed essential, nurses forced to advocate for proper PPE at their work sites, and teachers navigating the new landscape of school closures and online learning, the conditions are ripe for worker organization. What is a strike? How is it organized? And how can the community support worker actions? On today's episode, we'll be speaking with our comrade Chris Brooks of Labor Notes and NYCDSA's Labor Branch on the context for last Friday's May Day worker actions and what we might expect to see in the world of labor in the near future. Once again, my name is Amy Wilson. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm proud to be an organizer with the DSA of North Brooklyn. And my co-host today is the lovely and talented Jack Devine.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns. Thanks, Amy, for that great introduction to today's show. And now we're going to turn to the headlines from Simone Norman.
May 1st marked the start of a rent strike in New York, part of a nationwide movement by renters to resist eviction during the economic fallout from COVID-19. In New York City, over 12,000 renters have pledged to withhold rent this month, and specific landlords are being targeted by housing activists. The MTA is suspending overnight subway service for only the third time in the subway's history, leaving many commuters stranded. Critics see this as a potential precursor to more subway cuts or another excuse to arrest homeless people on the subway. Mayor de Blasio committed to opening up 100 miles of New York City streets for recreation during COVID-19, in addition to expanding sidewalks and creating temporary bike lanes. Although the city's Department of Homeless Services announced it had met its initial goal of moving 6,000 homeless New Yorkers out of shelters and into hotel rooms in order to stem the tide of COVID-19, their count apparently included thousands of people who were moved before the coronavirus outbreak. Some families who cannot afford the equipment for distance learning are getting visits from Children's Services. Cuomo has changed 262 laws by executive fiat since the coronavirus crisis began. And in an attempt to support local restaurants, the City Council will likely pass a bill that caps service fees at 10% for delivery apps like Grubhub. And in election news, the New York Board of Elections canceled the state's Democratic presidential primary, sparking anger and lawsuits from voters who will not get a say in selecting the state's delegates, and who see it as a ploy to protect local incumbents by driving down turnout from infrequent voters. Farrah Saffront-Forrest and Marcella Matane's campaigns for state assembly received favorable news coverage. Assembly candidate Zohran Mamdani in Astoria publicly excoriated the Queen's machine for kicking progressive challengers off of the ballot in June. Bronx congressional candidate Samelis Lopez participated in a cancel rent sign drop on the Queensboro Bridge. The Red Hook Star Review released an extensive update date of the competitive races for State Senate District 25, where Jabari Brisport is contesting an open seat against two others, and Assembly District 51, where Marcela Matanes is challenging incumbent Felix Ortiz, along with two others. Nearly 30,000 students were registered to vote during the city's Civics Week prior to the coronavirus outbreak, in part thanks to last year's law allowing high school students to pre-register before they turn 18. And finally, a judge overturned City Board of Elections' decision to suspend the special city council election to replace Rafael Espinal, but denied the petition of progressive challenger Sandy Nurse on technical grounds.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So today we are joined by a returning guest, and interestingly enough, it was probably one of the last times that we were in the studio that our guest today, Chris, was here. It was a much brighter mood on the left at that point. I believe that Bernie had just won in Nevada. There was a lot of momentum, you know, heading towards his campaign. We weren't yet quarantined. There was exciting worker actions going on out in California. And that aspect of this has continued. Workers are organizing and fighting back against the brutal conditions imposed by corporate and state power during coronavirus. Chris, can you hear me?
I can. Hi. Hi, Jack and Amy.
Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. So maybe for our listeners that weren't tuning in a few months back when you were on the show, can you just give a brief introduction, what sort of organizing you've been involved in, and why you're here today?
Yeah, I would love to. So thanks again for having me back. You're right, the mood has completely changed in the world since the last time I was there. So I'm a staff writer and organizer with Labor Notes, which is a media and organizing project that's been around for 40 years. And our motto is to put the movement back in the labor movement. So we believe in building a progressive, militant labor movement that's led by the workers themselves. And we support rank-and-file democratic movements across the country and across the world as we try to rebuild the world into one that values the labor that we produce every day. So we've been writing in this moment a lot about the worker actions that have taken place around the country and trying to support as much of that as possible.
Well, it's a really great and necessary to have these sort of kind of both a simultaneous media institution and an organizing training institution like Labor Notes that serves these multiple purposes and both kind of projecting out the worker struggles that are happening right now, while also trying to build organization, provide sort of training and just a site that workers can get together and kind of think strategically about how to build power in the long term. And we'll get to a kind of another working class institution that we're on right now, WBAI, and the need to raise money for it later in the show. But I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute. I'm listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Connect with us after the show. You can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. And you can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about worker struggles and particularly what happened on May Day this past week. So now I'm going to throw it over to Amy to pose some questions to Chris.
Yeah, so now that we're all thoroughly depressed about what's happened since between late February and today, let's talk about it. So starting off with the recent events of May Day 2020, which of course was last Friday, we'll dive more thoroughly into some big picture discussion of what a strike is later in the show. That's something we're really excited to be bringing to our audience here on Revolutions Per Minute. But looking at last Friday, both with sources on the ground and with this sort of media coverage of May Day, there were lots of things happening that were categorized under the same label of the word strike. So while we see large numbers of people collectively withholding their labor or their rent, workplaces like Amazon warehouses that were promoted in the media as being on strike were still engaged in production. And some of our sources there think that much deeper organizing is needed before taking a major strike action against Amazon. So without getting too far into that specific worker organizing, Chris, I'm curious if you can just summarize your take on what we saw happen last Friday in the world of labor.
Well, unfortunately, I think that we saw last Friday what we see every May Day, which is a lot of talk about a general strike that's pretty divorced from reality. General strikes don't happen by proclamation. They happen by organization. And unfortunately, in many of the workplaces that were specifically, you know, people were focusing on as having strike activity like Target and Walmart and Amazon and some of these, large retail chains, there was very little actual activity happening. That being said, it's wonderful that there's like we're in a political moment where people are hungry for strikes. They're hungry to support workers, and they recognize the gross inequalities that exist in society, and especially, you know, that are happening with these massive employers like Amazon, and they want to really support that activity. But there was nothing happening on a scale that was actually disrupting the day-to-day business of these companies in any significant way. So unfortunately, it kind of mirrors a lot of what we've seen in past years of strikes being used as kind of public relations stunts or like an advocacy, strategy for organizations to get their message out about what's happening in a workplace, and not really being able to leverage the actual power that workers have on the job by withdrawing their labor in significant numbers.
Right. Yeah. And Jack and I were actually talking in both the lead up to May Day and after May Day about labor groups that decided to take a different tack in acknowledging the holiday, which is International Workers' Day. I know that the Worker Center, New York Nail Techs United, decided to have a town hall with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and do some worker education, political education to mark the day. Amazon Workers International came out with a form, an interest form, to get involved with ongoing organizing. So you do see other approaches to marking May Day, but there's something that's sexy, if you will, about the word strike.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think, unfortunately, though, you know, there's this illusion that's been created that to strike, all you have to do is like create a Facebook page and then get the media to pick it up and then it'll somehow happen. So you have groups of people, and it's not clear that they're connected to actually any workers in any particular workplace, making these calls for strikes, and then nothing happens. And I think that for a lot of people, that just creates a confusing idea about what organizing is and what strikes are and how they work and how they function. So I think that, you know, what's great about what you're pointing out is that there are many organizations recognizing that they don't have maybe the power right now to strike, or maybe the workplaces are all closed because of the coronavirus. And so they're pivoting to do other things that are going to meaningfully move, their program or their agenda in other areas. But I think it's really important for people to recognize that striking takes a lot of organization. It takes a lot of work, and you can't just call it on social media or put out some really hot looking memes and assume that it's going to happen. Like, that's just not an effective way to do things.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really crucial point that you're making there, that we can't just like materialize these actions into existence by making these grand proclamations, and that there definitely was an exaggeration of what was happening on May Day. But I think at the same time, there has been an uptick in worker action since COVID-19. So I think it's like, how do we differentiate what's really happening from what's kind of like this media campaign from maybe pushing the interests of certain nonprofit organizations? Like, where do we see when workers are actually organized, making demands, and kind of gaining at least some health protections or changing the circumstances, where there has been real like organic working class activity? And then where is it where it's kind of being exaggerated on behalf of maybe something that it is a valuable long-term campaign, but is mischaracterizing the organizing necessary?
Right. And I would never want to, I would never want listeners of this show to think that, you know, we're sitting here denigrating the actual, the real worker organizing that certainly was happening. And of course, the response of the community that I think at this point really desperately wants to get involved with worker organizing and worker actions and wants to support people who we know are really on the front lines of this major a health crisis that we see, health and social crisis, I should say, that we see in COVID-19. So I think it's possible to acknowledge the very real seriousness of worker organization and also approach it with some skepticism, which is what I hope we'll do over the course of the show. And both of you started to talk about it, but I'd love, Chris, for you to dive into a little bit the role of the COVID-19 pandemic in labor organizing. Is it an opportunity? Is it a challenge? What are we seeing right now?
So we're definitely seeing a ton of working class activity taking place. I mean, like, there's so much stuff that's happening below the radar, below the news, you know, and the news has been capturing some of it, right, to a large degree. Like, we're seeing all of these actions take place all across the country. But there is just so much happening, especially in these essential industries. Where workers are being forced to go to work, you know, or are willingly going to work, but they're working in extremely dangerous, you know, environments. You know, so just as some examples, like the Detroit bus drivers went on a strike because you know, they were letting people on the bus. They were coming right into the front door, passing them. If the bus driver gets sick and if they're asymptomatic or they're sick for a few days before they even know it, they could potentially pass the virus on to everybody that comes on board. So they went on strike and they worked out a deal with the bus system to, one, make sure that the bus fares were free from here on out for everybody who has to ride it, two, that they would get onto the back of the bus and that they would limit their ability to get up front. So this would protect the drivers. So they came up with, you know, this bigger demand that was helping the public protecting themselves. And we're seeing this over and over again all across the country is, you know, slaughterhouse workers, you know, the meatpacking industry. We're seeing grocery workers and retail workers of all kinds. We're seeing delivery drivers, you know, and healthcare workers engaging in all kinds of collective action. In hospitals, just to give you an example, you know, hospitals are trying to force many nurses to work in deeply unsafe environments, not giving them the personal protective equipment or PPE that they need. So they're trying to make them go into rooms with COVID patients and not providing them, like, with the face masks that actually filter out the virus from the air. And, of course, if they're exposed, they're then going to expose everybody else that they come into contact with. So there have been multiple cases in hospitals from California to Chicago in New York of nurses saying, like, we're not abandoning our patients. We're right here in this break room and we're going to go in there to see them as soon as the management comes down here and gives me the PPE that I need. But I'm not stepping foot out of here until I get it, because I know that by going in there, I'm going to make things more dangerous for not only myself and my family, but for every other patient that I'm going to see later today and for all the other healthcare workers I work with. So we're seeing a ton of organic activity right now that's happening. But I think you're right. You know, the coronavirus is you know, it's creating mass unemployment. We're facing this really deep economic decline. You know, this is the second great, you know, depression potentially. Employers are going to try to, you know, use this to push for concessions and austerity. And on the other hand, it's also the greatest occupational safety and health hazard we've ever faced in our lifetime, you know, in several generations. So workers are being forced, you know, in this position increasingly of saying, like, my job or my life. I'm having to go work in these conditions that are deeply unsafe, not given the personal protective equipment I need, not given the safety standards in place, and potentially endangering myself and others, or I'm going to be out of a job and a time when it's going to be very difficult to find one. So, you know, this is a moment where people need to be organizing, and we have to have some big picture solutions as well.
Amy, can I just jump in there real quick before the next question?
Of course, yeah.
So, yeah, I just wanted, like, I absolutely agree with your analysis there. And I think, one, it's very encouraging to see all this, like, organic working class activity. And it's going to become even more and more crucial, especially with stuff that you're mentioning related to public safety, as we're seeing these absurd pushes by capital and the most reactionary factions of the state. But even Democrats are doing the same thing, where we're starting to see this push to drive people back to work. Even as, if you look at the projections that are coming from the same government, that this crisis is going to get worse and worse as the weeks go on. There's this effort to throw the working class and the most vulnerable populations of the working class into the fire and let them burn at the altar of capital accumulation. And it's going to be so crucial to be organizing both against what is happening with this public health crisis, the depression, and then there's the looming specter of climate change that we discussed on our last episode altogether. Like, what's going to happen when we have wildfires this summer as this public health crisis is going on in the midst of the depression? The worst case scenarios to me are something that are so horrible to even contemplate. But I think that's something that we all need to be considering, and that it needs to be central to the organizing efforts going forward. And it's very encouraging that these sort of actions for public safety are at the forefront of the worker struggles right now.
Yeah, well, since we're going worst case scenario, not to mention that, you know, there are lots of governors that have used the cover of this pandemic to completely restrict abortion access. We see the exact same social issues that were already present before the COVID pandemic. We still see family separation. American Airlines flew unaccompanied minors into LaGuardia under the orders of ICE, apparently, right at the beginning of this pandemic. So everything that was happening before the pandemic is still happening, and we expect it to accelerate. So that actually is a wonderful transition into our next question, which is Mayday's over, now what, right? So what do we see happening from here? Let's frame it as maybe the next 6 months to a year in worker organizing.
So I just wrote this piece at Labor Notes, and anybody can check it out at labornotes.org, that's really trying to frame, like, what is the science telling us? What is it that we should expect? So it's pretty clear that most scientists are skeptical that we're going to have a vaccine in anything from 12 to 18 months. That would be entirely unprecedented. You know, the fastest we've ever gotten a vaccine before was in 4 years. And we've never created any vaccine for any of the 7 coronaviruses that impact human beings. So, we've effectively right now, by not having mass testing and not having contact tracing in any significant way in the United States and opening up the lockdowns, we've just plateaued at the highest level of confirmed cases and deaths that we've had so far. And that is now just going to increase from here. So workers are going to be going back into these workplaces without the kind of mitigation that we need to be happening in society, you know, through testing and tracing, and the disease is going to be spread very quickly. And unfortunately, we cannot rely on the CDC in this moment because it has been entirely politicized. It has reduced its standards down to recommendations to things like face masks that are cloth, which have basically no impact on the spread of the disease. We can't rely on the federal government, but we can rely on each other, and people are going to have to. You know, the Republicans have a plan that they're instituting across the country, which is they're going to have employers reporting to the unemployment agencies with lists of names of people who aren't reporting to work after they open back up so they can cancel their unemployment insurance. So this is going to dramatically impact people's ability. They're going to say, like, you know, if I don't go back to work, then I'm going to, you know, I don't have anything else to fall back on. Most people are living paycheck to paycheck in this country. And then, you know, the next economic stimulus package that's coming through the Republicans is being tied or predicated on the idea of lowering the liability of their employers if anything happens should you go back to work, you know, so you can't sue them for having been exposed or, you know, for potentially dying. So this is creating a dangerous environment. Employers are trying to say, like, look, we don't want to be held accountable for workers going back to work, but we're going to force them into it anyways. And we're going to gut whatever, you know, welfare is out there right now to provide some sort of security for people in this moment. And we're going to try to get consumption back going. So, you know, workers are really going to have to rely on each other and on their ability to engage in collective action if they have any hope of protecting themselves, because the federal government is not going to do it. And in many places, the state government is not going to do it.
So we are going to talk more in the second half of our show about sort of big picture strategies for worker organization, which, as our guest today, Chris Brooks of Labor Notes and the New York City DSA Labor Branch, just reminded us will be essential in the coming months and years. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about worker organization and worker actions in the United States in 2020. And before we pick up for the second half of our show and our conversation, we will be taking listener calls as well. So get ready. But before we go there, I'm going to turn it over to Jack, who has a special request of you, our beloved listeners.
So, you know, we're having this really incredible conversation with organizers here today. We're talking about building working class power. And like, where else do you find something like that? I mean, maybe you'll get an occasional report on NPR that's doubled up with another thing on why like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates Foundation is so great. But, you know, here on WBAI, we're talking about the real issues and also talking about it through the perspective of people who are engaged in struggle. So, like, unlike what are these so-called progressive radio outlets, this station, WBAI, doesn't take money from the very same foundations and philanthropists who profit off of working-class misery. So what we're going to need and what this is really about is, like, becoming part of the WBAI community. And so many of our listeners already are. But this is like a really crucial time, and some people right now are really hurting. So obviously, if you are struggling to eat, this isn't the time for you to give this station. But if you still have your job or you've got some money coming in, this is time to show your solidarity with a working class institution like WBAI. So give until, I mean, you can give until it hurts, but maybe don't hurt yourself. Rather help yourself and donate to WBAI, contribute and say Revolutions Per Minute send you. If we're your favorite show, then that's the best way to highlight the sort of programming you want on here. So there's a few ways you can contribute to the station and demonstrate your solidarity with the WBAI community. You want to make a recurring donation? Go to our website, WBAI.org. Scroll down and click on BAI Buddy. Once you become a monthly contributor to our program, you'll receive a BAI Buddy card and a BAI Buddy tote bag. And you can also get a shout out like Marvin Gonzalez, who became a BAI Buddy in our name earlier today. Marvin is a really great comrade and we're really happy to have him. And we really appreciate that he became a buddy of BAI. And so we would really, really love for more and more people to show their solidarity and support. So that buddy is one way to do it. That's where you can say, I really like your program, like ours, Revolutions Per Minute. I want more shows with socialist organizers talking about what's happening on the ground, putting theory and practice together. But there's other ways you can donate to the station as well. You can make a one-time donation on the website. You just go to the top corner. There will be a little button that says one-time donation. Click on that. Contribute to the station, show your solidarity with working class media, which is more important in this time than ever. If you want to build power for people, if you want to challenge what's happening right now with unemployment, really, it's just absolutely crucial to become a contributor. So you can do that on the site, or you can go to the pledge drive number. Maybe you don't like using the internet. You'd rather call in. So you can call in at 516-620-3602. Again, that number is 516-620-3602. It's so, so important that we have, like, you saw what happened to Bernie Sanders in the primary. The Democratic media institution, it's not just the Democratic Party's media institutions. It's the institutions of the bourgeoisie, of the capitalist ruling class. They waged ideological warfare against Bernie to make sure that people were disinclined to vote for him, that they were afraid to vote for him. And that's why we absolutely, and that's just one of many reasons, like this highlighting of these worker actions that we're doing today, rather than the constant press that the capitalist media is giving to the very small number of people who are showing up at state houses, who are a bunch of petty bourgeois, small business, gun-toting, like homeowners who really just want to be served by the working class. No, this is an institution for, by, and of the working class. So please, please donate if you can. You become an elect, you can become a someone who has democratic rights within the institution of BAI. So, you know, now more than ever, if you have the money, if you're not suffering as much as other working class people, please do it. So again, you can go to WBAI.org, or you can call in at 516-620-3602. So now we're going to move on to our second topic. And this one is also really about working class organization and institutions. And, you know, this can come in various forms. There's, you know, older school unions, but then there's also new unions that form in these moments of crisis. And some of the kind of most transformative and powerful working class organizations that have really transformed the conditions of the working class in U.S. history have had come in moments of crisis, like the Civil War with the striking black slaves who consciously liquidated themselves as a class and ended slavery through their actions, or in the New Deal period with the emergence of the CIO and the industrial unions. So we can see this potential moment as really being transformative and empowering people, but that's going to take organization and action. So Chris, like, we always on the left are always talking about strikes and like how important they are. But like, what actually is a strike? What does it take, and why are strikes so important?
That's a great question. So, you know, the source of wealth, power, and privilege in society stems from capital's control of the workplace. That's where it all begins. And so the most powerful weapon that working class people have is the strike, which is our ability to collectively withdraw our labor. It's our ability to shut down production, to shut down services, and to stop the process of capital accumulation, to stop the process of profit-making and reproducing society itself. And that creates a crisis for the capitalist class, and we can leverage that crisis to win demands. So the strike historically has always been at the center of every major strategy to win big demands in U.S. society and in the world.
So this is the key spot, you know, and I would say, you know, it's in production. And then we've seen also really, I'd say, encouraging strikes at the point of social reproduction. But I think the power dynamic remains the same, where you have this concentrated ownership and control, and the way it can be confronted is through organized collective action of withdrawing labor. So can you get more into the details of like how strikes are organized? Like, how do you build up the organization it takes to go out on an action that is both as risky but as potentially powerful as a strike?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so big strikes in the ways that we need them are often, you know, hardcore affairs, you know. So just to give you an example, the United Teachers of Los Angeles organized this really profound strike in January of last year. And that strike was 4 years in the making. You know, they were able to get 35,000 workers to go out collectively together to put pressure on the school system and highlight how, you know, it was being modeled as a business. It was being intentionally defunded and disinvested into privatized, you know, to serve the interests of the rich and powerful. There was racist policies being implemented, and they were able to win a really big contract. But to do that, they had to really transform their union first. So a group of activists formed a caucus, so an internal organization with a different vision for the union. They were organizing in the schools. Then they got elected to leadership. And over the next 4 years, they did a series of campaigns to mobilize and engage the membership in a way that they never have before, and to start raising their expectations of what they could collectively do. So they raised their dues so they could hire more staff and organizers. They visited every school and made sure that they had leaders in every workplace that could actually prove that they were leaders by mobilizing their coworkers to do things. And then when the day came, they had a vote, you know, a vote to whether or not to go on strike. And this was heavily debated, heavily discussed in all of the workplaces and all the unions. And it was overwhelmingly approved by the membership. And so what you see is that they built a structure through which people could be engaged, through which they could debate, and through which they could take action. And because of that, they were able to engage in this really massive strike that then they also had huge amounts of public support for. You know, so I was there on the ground working with them on this. And, you know, they would have these massive convenings during the day in downtown Los Angeles. You know, it's over 30,000 people on strike, but the convenings would be over 60,000 people, you know, out mobilizing on behalf of teachers and with them because they were invested in their fight for public education. So, you know, I think that that kind of fight is just as capable of happening in the private sector. You know, unions are capable of really, I think, turning right now, especially in this political moment, their struggles into referendums on corporate greed. And people are really struggling, and they recognize the fact that it's totally unfair that Jeff Bezos has $139 billion, or that, you know, that the top 400 richest people in the U.S. have $2.9 trillion. You know, they could easily pay for everybody to get tested for coronavirus and to sit at home for the next 3 months and have a $10,000 check, and they would still all be billionaires, right? So, you know, I think that we're in a political moment where unions can be taking bigger risks, they can be striking, but they're eventually going to come up against the law, especially in the private sector. You know, this has been a huge problem. In the 90s, there were many significant strikes that were just absolutely crushed by the employers because they were able to permanently replace workers. So that means that when they go out, they were capable of bringing in other workers who then had their job permanently. You know, like so many countries, they talk about scabs, right? Scabs are people who go in and they break ranks. They go back into the factory to work, strike breakers. And they can be brought in from the outside, but in no other country in the world, you know, industrialized Western, you know, nations, do they allow for people to be permanently replaced. That is really unique to the United States. And that's why strikes have often been violent here, is because people literally have to protect their jobs by keeping people from going into those plants. And oftentimes it's been the police and the state on behalf of capital that has gone in to allow for this to happen, right? So, you know, there's a lot that's there, but it means that, like, in this current moment, we're going to need to have militant strikes. We're going to need to figure out how to break the law. We're going to need to mobilize large numbers of people, like, in our workplaces, but also in the broader community to support us if we hope to be successful.
Yeah, and I think that last point is something that I really, really want to hit on. I mean, you made a number of great arguments about, like, how this, the absurdity of the moment is really a potential way to draw more people into struggle as they see capitalists like Jeff Bezos piling up profits as millions of people go unemployed and tens of thousands of people die because they're forced to go to work. But on that point of community organizing alongside work organizing, and you mentioned the UTLA strikes, and it was the same with the CTU strikes or the West Virginia teacher strikes, where the workers there, they really committed to a broad vision beyond just like bread and butter demands, but about kind of transforming their communities as a whole, making demands that brought the community into the struggle more than just like, hey, we're going to not cross the picket line, but we're going to be organizing together to kind of really transform the fundamental material reality of the community. So, like, how can we really go beyond strike support as more than just don't cross a picket line and imagine as something then like larger than like an individual choice of buying or not buying from a store, but a way of building working class power rooted in the local community where the workers are taking action?
That's such a great question. So I think that, you know, one of the most exciting things that's happening right now is the Bargaining for the Common Good Network, which is this organization of, you know, it's a mixture of unions and labor leaders and academics all working together to try to expand out this framework of making big picture demands that involve everybody that tie an individual contract campaign or multiple contract campaigns to broader public demands. They're trying to say, like, look, let's be ambitious in this moment. Let's look at contract expiration dates across the country, especially in major cities, right? Millions of workers are going to have their contracts come up in the next 5 years. What if we all start working to line up our contracts? And what if we say, like, we have different employers, but we're all under the same system, and we're going to make really big demands, and if we potentially go on strike together, we might be able to actually have a chance to win them. So, you know, this is something we see in Chicago. The Chicago Teachers Union is just one of the best unions in the country. really militant, really progressive, very democratic, leading on these issues, right? They can go on strike, but ultimately they're up against the billionaires. You know, ultimately they're up against the entire capitalist apparatus in Chicago, and it's going to take more than just the teachers going out on strike for them to totally restructure the tax structure that exists in Chicago. For them to say, you know, we shouldn't be providing all these tax breaks to billionaires and to real estate developers and to big companies, but instead we should be taxing these people and then redistributing that to the working class. Well, in order to win the demand that big, you're going to need a lot more people in that fight. And so, you know, we've got to build out our unions as our bases, you know, as the vehicles for class struggle, get them all on board, and then also bring the community with it. And that's actually the beginnings of leading to something like a general strike. You know, these mass strikes that could be possible if you have multiple organizations with deep reaches, both in the workplace and in the community, capable of coordinating their actions together. I mean, there's actually a really great article on this in The Progressive by Sarah Jaffe that I would really recommend that people check out, really detailing what the Bargaining for the Common Good Network is doing. And I think this is just such a strong example, especially in Chicago, because they're working hand in glove with all of these community organizations and these really deep alliances they have with them, where they're having ongoing conversations about what the biggest needs in the city are, what their vision is, and how they can achieve it. So this is like one of the most meaningful advances I've seen recently in terms of an actual strategy that people have to start thinking about what it's going to take to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Bargaining for the Common Good Network is such an encouraging development, and it's that sort of organizing between multiple workplaces and a commitment to organizing outside of the workplace and kind of fusing these struggles together. And that's the only way we would ever be able to reach what is being aspired to and what we were talking about before with the quote-unquote general strike. To actually materialize that would take so much power and organized power. But I'm going to throw it over to Amy to open up the phone lines, and then we'll maybe give you a chance to more fully dive into that question.
Yeah, so before I open up the phones, I do just want to share another article recommendation. Chris recommended something by Sarah Jaffe, who's a wonderful labor journalist. And then, Chris, you'd also shared on your social media this article that I've been thinking about a lot called No More Fake Strikes, from a site called organizing.work that's published by members of the IWW. And the line that's really been sitting with me that I've been thinking about since I read it is that before calling for a general strike, you personally should be confident that you could get at least 10 people to go out on strike, which I think is, if nothing else, hopefully it will encourage people to think deeply about what is involved in a strike, as Chris outlined so eloquently just now. So we'll go ahead and open up our phone lines. We've got three labor nerds here on Revolutions per Minute: me, Amy Wilson, Jack Devine, and Chris Brooks. So if you have a question or a constructive comment for us, please give us a call, 212-209-2877. Once again, that's 212-209-2877. And while we wait for someone to give us a call, Chris, do you have a thought about that you should be able to get 10 people to go on strike thing?
Yeah, I do. So I'll just say a couple of things. Is organizing.org is such a great website of lively debate, and I really appreciate the fact that they, you know, published this piece by Joe Burns, who's a wonderful author and actually a bargainer with the flight attendants union and has a lot of experience with strikes. And I think that, like, his point, which is well taken, is that all strike threats should be credible, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we don't believe in pretending, right? And, you know, oftentimes a really powerful strike pay dividends in the future contract negotiations because the employers don't want to go through that again. You know, so if you strike once really well, you often don't have to strike again for a while. I mean, it doesn't mean you shouldn't, but it just goes to show like the idea of a credible strike threat is oftentimes enough to win some concessions from employers. And so we shouldn't be pretending or boasting about something that we can't actually do. We should be really serious about what our strategy is and about what power is and how it operates and how we're going to win it. And, you know, unfortunately, and I think Joe does a great job of highlighting this, is that there's just been a lot of fake strikes. You know, there's been a lot of these PR strikes, public relations strikes. You know, I actually think that the fight for 15 has been such a net good for society. It's really raised expectations about this. You know, you think about, you know, just a couple years ago, the idea of a $15 minimum wage would have been laughed at, you know, but now it's the reality in 24 states and 48 cities. So I think it's an example of a really strong advocacy campaign. but it's not the same as like really meaningful deep workplace organizing in the sense that like you're not seeing large numbers of workers who are capable of shutting down production at a work site. It's often maybe one or a few workers, mostly community members, showing up and getting media support, which is not, you know, I don't want to like belittle that. It's done a lot of good. But is it going to be enough moving forward with the imbalance of power in society? Is it going to give us the kind of power we need to do the big things that we know we have to do, given the corona crisis, given, you know, the depression that we're heading into, and given climate change? I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like we do have a caller on the line who has a question or comment about labor and strike solidarity. Reggie, can you put him on live?
Okay, go on.
All right, caller, you are live with Revolutions Per Minute. What's your question or comment?
Thank you very much for the program. I live in Suffolk County. I live in one of the 10 towns in Suffolk County where you called at the beginning of the show for a World Labor Report. I am interested in how to organize. Now, I've heard a little bit about it, but the leadership necessary to mobilize people, the training, I would like some shows dedicated to more of what the man said. He did it very fast, and so I'd like that to hear more on that. And do you organize and teach local towns? You know, some of these towns have 25,000 people in them, at little towns. And I'm familiar with James Connolly from Ireland, who wrote the book Socialism and Nationalism, the idea that socialism can exist nationalistically, not just internationally. And so I'm wondering, what is your thrust? Is it international? Do you work at the also local town levels? And that's what I'm interested in hearing about.
Awesome. Thank you so much for calling in, and I will bounce that over to Chris for a response. If you'd like, Chris.
Hi, thank you for calling. Sure. So we published a book, Secrets of a Successful Organizer, that you can check out on our website, labornotes.org. And we have been doing a series of webinars about how to organize that we're going to continue to do in the future. We often do trainings in many places for workers about how to organize in your workplace. Many of those principles are applicable to the broader community. And I'm sorry, I do speak very fast. I'm probably the fastest talking Southerner you might hear in a while. but, you know, the principles are all outlined, you know, on our website, in our materials, which you can check out, and in our book. And, you know, oftentimes I think, you know, good organizing is often about just getting people in a room and starting to have a conversation about what the issues are in your community. What are the things that are widely and deeply felt by most people? What is really going to rouse in them the desire to take collective action together? Who's the decision maker who can help to change those issues and change those conditions? And what can you do to influence them? Just walking through those series of questions can often be a great starting point for organization, for collective action together. And I think you're totally right that, you know, international work is really important. I mean, we see right now how the global supply chain is being impacted by the coronavirus. You know, we are in a global economy. We're in a global world where a virus that starts in China is impacting us here today. And so we have to take the idea of international working class power really seriously and think about how we are organizing across borders and across barriers in order to build the kind of movement that's going to be capable of taking on these companies and states.
And thanks so much for the call. It sounds like we've got another caller on the line.
Okay, they're ready.
All right. Hi, you're on live with Revolutions Per Minute. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Erebos. I'm in West Harlem. I wanted to share an insight provided by Professor Webster Griffin Topley on his Sunday program, World Crisis Radio. And he suggested that when it comes to organizing, you know, looking at the historical model, you want to get everyone, not just employed workers, but unemployed workers. Because what happens is, if you don't include the unemployed folks, the companies and, you know, the corporations, they'll organize them as scabs and strike breakers against you. So when it comes to mass traction demands, he suggested, based on the historical model, that it should include all workers, everyone. I just wanted to. I agree with that insight personally, and I just wanted to share it with you. And I think you have an excellent program and a wide lateral point of view, as opposed to just the typical identity politics that I usually hear on this station. So I commend you, and I just wanted to share that insight.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing that insight. I think that's a point that's very well taken. I think a sad part of the history of labor is how often it's neglected to organize people who are already marginalized. So if you have Black workers who are discriminated against and they're put to work as scabs or strike breakers, although, you know, in the labor world, scab is a really powerful term, I think it's worthwhile to interrogate that a little bit, especially if we're speaking historically, and look at the places where organized labor has historically had its blind spots, of which race and ethnicity is certainly one, in my opinion. Jack or Chris, do you have a direct response to that before we move to close our show?
Just to jump in quick, I mean, I think the point about one, both organized, the unorganized is crucial, and that's workers who are not in unions, which is the vast majority of them. And then also always, but particularly now, organizing unemployed workers, I mean, people who are unemployed, who are seeking work, is absolutely going to be so crucial if the numbers of it's always very, very important. But like in the Great Depression, some of the most effective strikes, like something like the Toledo Autolite strike, kind of organized alongside the unemployed and were able to make really successful gains because of the kind of fusion of in the workplace and out the workplace organizing, so they couldn't be overwhelmed on their picket lines.
So yeah, totally Jack, would you like to help us?
Chris, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'll just say one last thing about this is you know, you're right about the big demands, but also to Amy's point, you know, right now in a lot of these essential industries, the most dangerous jobs that are being worked are by Black and immigrant workers. You know, so you think right now about how the hotbeds for the coronavirus in the United States, those counties that actually have a higher per capita case of the coronavirus spreading than New York City, are rural communities where there are these large slaughterhouses that exist. And immigrant workers are really being, and Black workers in the South, are being inundated with the virus, and these companies have done absolutely nothing to slow the spread of it and to keep them safe, and the government has done absolutely nothing. And this is going to continue as, you know, the economy opens back up, is that we see, because of, we live in a racist society, that the worst jobs often go to people of color, and those are going to be the most unsafe jobs. And that's why, partly, why there's just been such a disproportionate impact of this virus in terms of confirmed cases and deaths in communities of color. And this is something that we really need to address. You know, we have the medical injustices and racism in our country, and then we also have the workplace injustices. And we need to tackle both of them in the labor movement.
That's such a crucial point, and I would love to kind of further elaborate on that, the racialized division of labor in our society. But we do have to wrap up, but I just want to give you the chance to briefly summarize how people connect with Labor Notes in the Labor Branch. So if you could just run down on that in less than a minute, that would be great.
Great. So please go to labornotes.org and join our weekly e-blast. You know, you can sign up right from there. If you're in New York City, please join the Labor Branch. We're having weekly organizing calls around the coronavirus that you can sign up at tinyurl.com/DSALBcalls. DSA Labor Branch Calls. So tinyurl.com/DSALBcalls. And then, of course, if you're in a workplace and you're scared about going back to work, or you're already there and things are happening, you could reach out to DSA to try to get help organizing on the job. And there's a form you can fill out at tinyurl.com/NYCDSAjobs. So that's tinyurl.com/NYCDSAjobs.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for joining us and sharing that information with our listeners. We would love to give you more time to elaborate, but we are getting to the end of the hour, and I'll let Amy close off the show.
Yeah, so of course we're going to put those links that Chris Brooks, our guest for today, just read out into our show notes. So do visit our website at revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com or follow us on Twitter at NYCRPM. We really want to help you get connected to organizing, so please do follow us so we can do that. Thanks so much, Chris, for being on with us today. He's gone. Wow. Rude. Okay. So thank you to all of our listeners. Thanks to Jack for co-hosting. I'm Amy Wilson.
I'm Jack Devine.
And this has been Revolutions Per Minute.